Hello, listeners. I'm Amy McKinnon, National Security Reporter at Foreign Policy, and this is Foreign Policy Playlist. Are you overwhelmed by the sheer number of podcasts out there, feeling spoiled for choice? Well, then let us be your guide. Each week, we will recommend one podcast from somewhere around the world. This week, I'm featuring Overheard at National Geographic, which is now in its sixth season. If you've ever wondered what it might be like to go for a beer with the explorers and scientists at National Geographic and hear firsthand all of the incredible tales they have to tell from their travels, that's basically what this show is about. Overheard tells the story behind the story that you see in National Geographic. On the episode that we're going to feature today, hear from National Geographic photographer Keely Wien, who spent months camping on sea ice with Inupiaq whale hunters in the Arctic, and how climate change is threatening this ancient tradition. But first, I spoke to Eli Chen, a senior editor at Overheard, about the ideas behind the series. I love your series, and I also love the title, because I also think it kind of a little bit resonates with the foreign policy newsroom. Like, if people could overhear the conversations that we have, they're not as exciting as Nat Geo, like, sending photographers off to all these amazing places in the world, but we do have intensely nerdy, very specific conversations. I think of National Geographic as a very visual medium. Obviously, you have incredible reporters that write for you, but, like, it's that feeling of like that glossy magazine feel, these beautiful pictures. How has it been translating that into like a rich storytelling audio experience? And how do you work with your reporters and your photographers to kind of to get that?
Yeah, I love this question because, you know, when I got into radio about a decade ago, I was told that, you know, radio is really theater of the mind. It's in fact, in some ways, the most visual medium, because if radio is done really well, you can really see in your mind, you know, what the reporter is portraying to you.
Totally.
And that's something that we try to accomplish in, you know, 25 minutes of an Overheard episode, is getting so descriptive and so visceral with what we're trying to describe, you know, in whatever part of the world we're in, you know, these stories that that take you to such different places that you feel like immersed in the story that's being told. And, you know, I just worked on a piece about the adventures of one of our photographers, Keely Wien, and, you know, he was so descriptive about, you know, what it was like to be out there on the Arctic ice, sort of camping with these indigenous whale hunters, that, you know, especially with the sound that he gave us, the sound that he captured of like seeing bearded seals underwater, or the sounds of, you know, bowhead whales. You know, I really felt like I was out there.
All of your staff and contributors must come back with incredible tales from where they go. But what for you makes for a great Overheard story? What do you look for and say that's an episode?
One of the most important things is having a good character to lead you down that path. Whether it's one of the Nat Geo explorers, a journalist, photographer. You know, there's usually a Nat Geo connection to every one of our episodes, so that's something we look for. But we also, you know, you're not going to listen to something that's told by somebody very dull. You want someone very engaging to sort of bring you down the path of an unusual and strange story, which is what we try to accomplish with most of our episodes. And we try to find, you know, sort of an element of like mystery or surprise or something that will, you know, captivate you to want to know more about what this story is about. So, you know, in the case of the snow leopard episode earlier this year, you know, how do you find snow leopards? This is something that people have wanted, like, there for a really long time there had only just been one or a few photographs of actual snow leopards in the Himalayas. Nowadays, there are lots of people with photos of them because tourism has grown so much. But, you know, there's that sort of intrigue that we try to insert in each episode. I'm also thinking about this other piece that one of my producers was working on when we first joined, about the world's largest tornado, which is the El Reno tornado that happened in Oklahoma, you know, I think a couple of decades ago. And it was this tornado that killed, that killed storm chasers for the first time, I think. It was a really great story in that, you know, there was, there were, you know, really interesting characters involved. Wow. And there was this really kind of fantastic natural event that, you know, caused people to have a different look at, you know, storms and what they mean to us and what we can do about them. So, you know, what we try to do, especially at the end of each episode, is come away with a different view of a subject, if that makes sense. One thing I want to add about where Overheard is headed, you know, it's been sort of 2 years of all kinds of stories, but something that we're really trying to focus on going forward is showcasing, you know, explorers from, you know, all different backgrounds, you know, because the experiences, especially of Nat Geo's Black explorers, they haven't gotten the spotlight as much as some of the others. And, you know, they're out there doing amazing stories. They're, you know, they're exploring, you know, we have plans to showcase folks who are out trying to understand how wildfires are affecting the environment, or you know, doing things like exploring our urban environments. And so we want to touch on that as well. And you know, the Keeley Wien episode is an example of like our, you know, us reaching out to communities or trying to showcase stories that haven't been told as much. You know, Keeley, something he does really well is try to understand, you know, how the indigenous community sees itself. And because so many stories about Native people have been sort of filtered through like a white anthropological lens. And, you know, even in journalism, you know, it's hard to get away from that lens. And so he's someone who's really taken the time to immerse himself in a community and, you know how to tell stories about them.
As our listeners will learn in an episode, his family is from an indigenous group in Siberia, and that gives him a different perspective on working with the Inupiaq people in the Arctic. And I think he really brings that to bear in the episode.
One of the things that I was aware of going into this is that this is, you know, if presented in one way, people might wonder, you know, if it's a good thing that, you know, this indigenous group is hunting bowhead whales. But what Keeley does is he helps you understand that this is a part of like a very old heritage. You know, hunting bowhead whales is done in a very particular way by the Inupiaq people, and they have been doing so for thousands of years. And, you know, and they've also, you know, done a lot to oppose commercial whaling and other things that actually threaten bowhead whales. And so the story here is very complicated. And it really shows why these people are really key to conserving, you know, this animal species. And that's what I think. It's not just this story, but some of Keeley's other reporting that I believe is ongoing really shows that, you know, Native people need to be part of the conversation when it comes to conservation and the environment. And oftentimes they've been really left out of it. So, you know, even though we package this story as like, oh, here's this adventure story about a photographer who went out camping with indigenous hunters and had to escape collapsing sea ice and, you know, face off with a, you know, polar bear that wanted to, like, you know, eat them. There's just a lot more to that. And you come away, hopefully, with the fact that, you know, the Arctic has been changed so much by climate change and has really changed these people's lives.
Thank you so much for making the time. And it was great to hear more about Overheard and how you put it together.
Awesome. Amy, thank you so much for your time.
That was Eli Chen, senior editor at Overheard at National Geographic. And now here's the episode from their latest season, Camping on Sea Ice with Whale Hunters.
An EVU is an amazing word for something terrifying. It is when the pack ice that is floating on the other side of the ocean gets pushed by the wind and it comes in and impacts the ice that we're standing on.
This is photographer Keely Rien. In 2018, he was on his first National Geographic assignment north of the Arctic Circle near Utqiagvik, Alaska. He was documenting the bowhead whale hunting rituals of the Inupiaq people. And to do this, he camped with the native hunters for weeks on Arctic ice, where temperatures stay below freezing and there's nothing but ice and sea for miles.
There was one whaling season when we happened to put our camp on a place where we knew that the ice was a little bit unstable, that there was a crack in the ice between the land and where we were.
So Keely shared the story of this journey and other adventures with our senior editor, Eli Chen. Hey, Eli. Welcome to the microphone. We're dragging you from behind your editor's desk and throwing you in the mix here. This sounds like a crazy story.
Yeah, it is, Peter. So that day, Keely had been camping with a whaling crew on sea ice, of all places.
Yeah, this sounds really dicey.
Oh, totally. I mean, Keely is thrilled to be there, but all sorts of things can go wrong.
And so we kind of were always had someone going back and forth to check on this little crack in the ice and make sure that we weren't going to crack off and just float away somewhere, which definitely happens.
Yeah, total nightmare scenario. So how do you even prepare yourself for an adventure like this?
Well, one of the things the crew did was sleep fully dressed every night in case of an emergency. One night it was Keely's turn to keep a lookout for any EVUs, and that's when he heard some rumbling.
And one of our guys came down racing on his snow machine, and he came up and he was like, we gotta go right now, you know, and I knew right away, like, okay, this is the time.
Okay, so how does an EVU happen?
Well, the way an EVU happens is kind of like plate tectonics. One plate of ice that could be several miles wide and many meters thick slowly moves and hits another plate of ice. Keely says that can buckle all that ice in as far in as 3 miles.
So we have to get off of that ice as fast as possible.
Keely woke the captain, and the entire crew rushed to gather all their belongings into their skin boat, and that took about 15 minutes. But what was really memorable for Keely was how the ice felt under his feet.
And what was really creepy about that moment was that as we were packing everything up, I suddenly felt it. I felt this, like, this thing that was unsettling, and I didn't quite know what it was at first, and then I realized what it was that the piece of ice that we were standing on was bobbing up and down. Like, it no longer felt like solid ground the way it normally feels, but it felt like, oh, we're floating on something, and that's the really unsettling feeling.
That's crazy. What was sort of going through your mind at the time?
You know, it was a bummer that I couldn't film it, really. You know, I mean, like, this moment is happening. This is an incredibly dangerous moment. And I was thinking, gosh, when things are going wrong, that's when you need to have the camera out. That's when you're photographing, because these are the things that are happening that are real, that people don't get a chance to experience and understand what it is. But I also knew, absolutely, that the number one priority was making sure that we were all safe and that the gear was safe and that, you know, like, the captain would toss me off the crew in a second if he saw me taking a picture instead of working on everything.
I'm Eli Chen, and you're listening to Overheard at National Geographic, a show where we eavesdrop on the wild conversations we have at Nat Geo and follow them to the edges of our big, weird, beautiful world. This week, a photographer shares what he experienced over 5 years while camping on sea ice with native Arctic whale hunters, and how climate change is increasingly becoming a threat to the lives of these hunters and could forever change their ancient traditions. More after this. Every spring, the ice that stretches from the North Pole all the way to Alaska cracks and melts and gives way to the ocean. When that happens, the Inupiaq do what they've done for thousands of years. Men and women head out to where the ice meets the sea and look for bowhead whales as they begin their migration from the Bering Sea to the Canadian Arctic. The black-bodied whales have triangle-shaped heads that they use to break through the ice, and they can live up to 200 years, making them one of the longest-living mammals in the world. And when they spot the whales, hunting crews set out on umiaks, long boats made of animal hide, in hopes of catching bowhead whales.
I love being out. I'll, like, wake up at 10 p.m. and then be up through the night.
Keeley spent collectively 10 months over 5 years with these whaling crews. He often volunteered to be the night watch, keeping an eye out for evus and other threats. The skies are often overcast, but during the spring, it's light out all through the night.
The light is glorious and it's beautiful. It's like sunset for several hours of the day because it's 24-hour light. And I wake up, I just go out, and I sit down at the windbreak, which is basically one of the sleds put on top of big blocks of ice.
It's mostly quiet until the wildlife start to sing.
And then I hear the bowhead whales going off in the distance, you know, coming up. And then, you know, I can hear the eiders flying by, you know, as they migrate by. And I just, like, after a while, I kind of, on those really good days, I just sort of lose myself. You know, I don't know where I end and the sea ice begins. You know, it's all just one continuous thing that's happening.
The hunters also listen for wildlife in the water. Keeley would watch a co-captain of the crew stick a wooden paddle in the water and plant the end of the paddle to his ear to listen for sounds of whales.
You hear this deep droning sound, like a deep male opera singer kind of, and it just goes on and it's very slow. And then there's the bearded seals who are singing almost like sort of like pop singers, you know, they're like, it's very flighty and full of different ups and downs, and it's really quick.
Access to fruits and vegetables is extremely limited in northern Alaska, so the Inupiaq heavily depend on muktuk, or whale skin and blubber, for essential vitamins and nutrients. Their diet also includes seals, walruses, and other Arctic animals, so the Inupiaq people learn how to hunt in childhood.
A lot of my Inupiaq friends will say that the ocean is our garden, because all the food in the form of marine mammals and animals that, you know, that come from the ocean.
The whale also feeds them spiritually. It's so central to their culture that every spring they hold a festival where everyone in the community gets a share of the muktuk. And for 3 days they sing traditional songs, dance, tell stories, and celebrate what the whale has given them. How many whales might these hunters capture in a season?
The village of Ukiavik normally gets around 6 or 7 whales in the season. You know, it can vary a lot.
But Keeley says the Arctic environment has changed drastically in recent years, and that's had a real impact on whale hunting. He says last year was the first season where no one caught any using a traditional skin boat. They had to use a motorboat to catch them.
And that was a really big deal. That was an enormous deal because no one understood why the whales weren't coming. As it turns out, it's probably climate change related because the ice had receded so much.
Arctic ice has been melting at alarming rates because of rising global temperatures. And the increasing ice melt means more open water up in the Arctic and more distance between the ice and the whales.
So they weren't getting close enough for the hunters to access. So that turns out to be a big problem because those whales feed a lot of people.
When the crew sees a whale, they'll rush from the ice into their boat, row right up to the whale, and spear it using harpoons. Then they'll tie a rope around its tail and tow it back to the village. Once they get there, they have to pull this whale ashore, an animal that can weigh more than 60 tons.
There is about 50 people pulling on it with a rope that goes through a series of pulleys, and the bulk of the whale is still in the ocean.
Keeley saw this tug of war between about 50 people and one huge whale. And while people are trying to pull the whale, sheets of ice will break off from under them, under the sheer pressure of the whale's weight.
So that's really not good, because that means every time the whale breaks through and breaks chunks of ice, that means we lose hours of work, because it takes hours and hours and hours to pull up a whale with all of these people and a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to get the whale up.
The crew will try their best to find a thick body of ice to pull the whale up on, but...
sea ice is so thin now that it's really hard to find any place to pull up the whales at all.
Keely knows that whale hunting can be a touchy subject, especially with the general public.
Like I see in my Instagram comments, and I know that when I talk about whaling, that for non-Indigenous peoples, the first thing they think of is, oh my God, how can you guys be hunting whales, these beautiful creatures, when there's so few whales left?
Keely says the Inupiaq have hunted bowhead whales for so long that they have tactics for hunting them without over-harvesting them.
The Inupiaq know which ones are pregnant females, and they won't hunt those. There's a strong taboo on that. They know which ones to chase down and how to hunt, what seasons to hunt, and they do things like hunt from traditional skin boats to make sure that the take isn't too large, etc.
But commercial whaling that started in the 18th century and lasted until the early 20th century decimated the bowhead whale population. The International Whaling Commission then tried to ban Alaskan native bowhead whaling in 1977, and the Inupiaq fought for the right to hunt and manage their own bowhead whale population. Keely says that the population rose after the Inupiaq began managing it.
The bowhead whale population has literally tripled in the last 40 years. It's an amazing, amazing feat. And now Inupiaq are known as the poster children for Indigenous traditional knowledge.
The Inupiaq want to protect the species to preserve their ancient culture and ensure that the whales will be around for their children and many generations after that.
Conserving the land is all about having a relationship with the things in it. If we don't have our hands in the water, if we don't have our hands on the wildlife, you know, if we aren't deeply engaged, if they're not feeding us, you know, literally feeding us, then we forget about them.
So, as we've established, trying to catch a whale is hard work. And on top of that, the Inupiaq hunters also have to deal with another major threat, one that's gotten worse in recent years.
Do you want to hear about the polar bear attack?
Sure.
That's a good one.
Yeah, tell me about the polar bear attack. Just to set up this story, Keely is on his first trip with an Inupiaq whaling crew. They spent a pretty exhausting week chopping down ice mountains. The ice is full of them. And they'd made their way to the edge of the ice sheet to set up camp.
And we get there and everyone's relaxing for their first moment of time.
But even when you're tired, you have to stay vigilant.
And then all of a sudden I hear, Nanuk, Nanuk, which means polar bear in Inupiaq. Boy, I heard that, like I could just sort of feel all of my senses like snap into sharp relief. I was like, oh my God, something is happening big time, you know? And my first thought was, oh gosh, there's a polar bear out there. Do I have the right lens on?
Keely and other members of the crew didn't see the polar bear at first. They looked all over the horizon for it.
And then I see it all of a sudden, and it's right there. And I realize that I've been looking like out on the horizon, and it's not on the horizon. It's way closer. It's less than 15 yards away from us, like, which is very close. That is way too close for a massive predator like that.
The polar bear looked like it was going to charge at them. Keely remembers one crew member next to him searching through his pockets.
He's got a rifle in his hand and the bolt is, the chamber is empty. He's looking around for bullets. But there's no bullets in any of his, got no ammo in any of his pockets or anything.
And then another crew member, a hunter named Mukalik, sprang into action.
And he has grabbed his rifle and spun around 180 degrees and taken a shot before he's even stopped moving. And this polar bear, which is in mid-motion, just collapses to the ground and skids forward.
Mukalik hit the bear right in the spine, killing it immediately.
My heart is racing, of course, and we're waiting, and the polar bear is just lying there, not moving or anything, but everyone knows that it's still dangerous.
The crew throws some blocks of ice at the bear, just to make sure it's dead. Then they go over to inspect it.
One of the things that was surprising to me was when we opened its mouth, you could see that of the four canine teeth, these giant, you know, these massive, you know, like human thumb-sized teeth, that two of the four were broken and they had cavities.
Keeley says the cavities indicate that the bear is old or diseased. The men also noticed it was really skinny, and they wondered why the polar bear was there.
A Nanook is not a stupid animal. They would never attack a group of men like that, even though it's this large, massive predator, because animals in the wild, they don't take chances. They don't take risks. They have to know that they're not going to get injured in the process.
So they followed the bear's tracks in the snow.
And what we found was even more chilling, actually.
Basically, they traced the Nanook steps back to an area where two crewmen had been repairing snow machines. It looked like the bear positioned itself to attack the men, but just then they had finished repairs and headed back to rejoin the crew.
So the polar bear had seen that, and you can kind of see it's pacing around a little bit, trying to figure out what to do.
Then it crept to where there were a bunch of giant boulders big enough for it to hide.
You know, it would walk for a little bit, then it would crawl for a little bit until it got so close that that it was right underneath us. You know, it's just an amazing thing.
These conflicts between polar bears and people are happening so often now that they've become a part of life for people in the Arctic. That's in large part due to climate change melting the ice that seals and other animals depend on. When the ice retreats in the summer, bears will follow the ice and the seals that live on it. They'll travel hundreds of miles to stay near their food source. But catching a seal in open water is more difficult than catching one on ice. So when prey is hard to find, the Nanook come after people.
If anyone goes anywhere, you have to have a rifle.
That includes the teenage boys on the whaling cruise.
You never go more than 30 yards away from the tent or from another person, even to take a poop. Because really, you know, there's a very good chance that a polar bear is right behind an ice boulder that you are walking towards, and it will grab you and you will be dead before anyone can help you.
More after this. When you make it back home after fleeing collapsing sea ice, surviving attacks from polar bears, and towing home a massive whale, it's time to celebrate.
The whaling festival called Nilukatuk is it's just an amazing thing. It's the moment in time when it becomes really clear that whale hunting isn't just about eating the food, but that it's very much about the gift of the whale.
Kira! One, two, three!
Everyone gets their share of the whale meat, and for multiple days they sing, dance, and jump on the traditional trampoline. Dozens of Inupiaq people will hold a blanket that's made of seal, walrus, or whale, and they'll hold it taut to turn it into a trampoline. It's tradition for the whaling captain and his wife to jump first. Then people will take turns, jumping as high as 20, 30 feet in the air.
Wait for him! Three, go!
Keeley says it's scenes like this that showed him what story he was really there to tell.
You know, I came in thinking that this would be a great story about whaling and the whale hunt, and realized eventually that what it was really about was community, about how community comes together, and about the relationship between the bowhead whale and the Inupiaq people.
It's worth mentioning that Keeley has a personal connection to Indigenous people. Could you talk about why you're drawn to Native communities and telling stories about them?
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways the biggest draw for me is wanting to get something back that I had lost.
Keeley is Chinese American and Nanai, or Siberian Native. During the Communist Revolution, Keeley's parents fled China for the United States.
With the Communist Revolution in China, that really kind of took away my homeland from my parents and myself. You know, we were forced to migrate and forced to leave. My parents were refugees, which is the story of so many East Asian people. And so for me, going to these indigenous communities is a way for me to feel like I was getting a part of that back.
His name, Keeley, is also connected to folklore. As a kid, Keeley grew up hearing mythical stories told to him by his grandmother, who grew up with the Nanai tribe. These are hunter-gatherers who live alongside the Heilongjiang River, which separates China and Russia. One of these stories is about a hero named Keeley, a man who could transform into an orca whale.
I think to myself, gosh, why did I become so interested in hunting and fishing and being out on the land and interested in people who were living so close in that relationship? And that's absolutely due to my grandmother just sort of filling my head with all these cool stories, which I think as a kid really swept me away.
Keeley says many stories about indigenous people are told through a Western, Eurocentric lens, which may not take into account cultural differences and the ways they affect how a journalist reports a story.
And one of those things is permission. You know, in Western culture, for the most part, you have the ability, I mean, you can do anything you want to unless told otherwise. But for indigenous communities, it's the other way around. You really don't have permission to do anything unless you've been specifically allowed to. So it's a huge difference in the way that things work.
Most news organizations, including National Geographic, have a policy of not compensating interview subjects. But the Inupiaq culture operates on a gift economy, so Keeley has made sure to give something in return to the people he's documented.
It is important to acknowledge that when they're sharing of themselves and sharing their stories and sharing their culture and family lineage, that's respected, and that is you understand that that's a real true contribution. So the thing that I do is I try to make sure that anyone I take a portrait of gets a print in the mail. No matter where it is they live, I always make sure to send them that. And if I tell someone that I'm going to send them a picture, I do.
And Keeley says news publications often will parachute a reporter into an indigenous community for a very brief amount of time. He says journalists need to spend months and years to build trust with native people.
Even though I have indigenous ancestry, that doesn't mean that I understand what's going on in the community either. But at least I know well enough to spend a lot of time in a place to be really open-minded and to try to understand that the culture that I am learning about and spend weeks, months there to finally get in to be able to put on a pair of goggles that allows me to see from, say, like the Inupiaq point of view.
And that's why he spent years with the Inupiaq.
So when you come back, it shows to people that you are actually committed, that you really want to be there, you really want to share the story. And it becomes this magical thing when people see you again. They're like, oh, hey, I know you. You're my friend. You know, let's hang out together. And also, that happens to be the best part of the job, is just hanging out with people, getting to spend time with them, and living. You know, it's just that part of living, which is really wonderful. I love that part of it.
If you'd like to learn more about bowhead whales and even hear their songs, we have a story in our show notes featuring recordings of their wild sounds. We also have more in-depth coverage on the challenges facing polar bears in the Arctic. To see Keeley's stunning photography and short film about the Inupiaq people and their whale hunting traditions, Nat Geo subscribers can check them out in an online story titled Meet the Bowhead Whale Hunters of Northern Alaska. You can also follow Keeley on Instagram at KeeleyYuyan. That's KeeleyYuyan. Where you can see amazing portraits he's taken of native people, wildlife, and maybe my favorite thing, kayaks that he built himself. That's all in the show notes, right there in your podcast app.
And that was the episode, Camping on Sea Ice with Whale Hunters. My thanks to National Geographic for sharing their podcast with us. Make sure to check out all 6 seasons wherever you get your podcasts or online at nationalgeographic.com. That's all for Farm Policy Playlist. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe. And if you want to suggest a great podcast, please email us at podcasts@farmpolicy.com. This show is hosted by me, Amy McKinnon, and it is produced by Darcy Palder, Rob Sachs, Rosie Julin, and Zimone Perez. Our executive producer of podcasts is Dan Efron.